Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording from our studio in East County. Today, I'm speaking with Stephen Prusky, who is a director at Rescue Task Force. They are a nonprofit that actually started here in San Diego's East County, and they're now headquartered in Temecula. They're perhaps best known for bringing medical teams to places that are in need in areas around the world, such as Southeast Asia and Central America, as well as responding to disasters around the world, helping survivors, including Hurricane Ida most recently. But they've also long had a team inside Afghanistan, among other things, establishing schools to educate girls. And now that work has been decimated by the Taliban takeover after the U.S. troop withdrawal, and Rescue Task Force's own coordinator and his family are trapped inside Afghanistan. As I mentioned, my very special guest today is Stephen Prusky, a director at Rescue Task Force. Stephen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure, and I appreciate it.
In these tough times, especially, can you start by telling listeners who may not be that familiar with it about Rescue Task Force work in Afghanistan? How did that ever get started, and what did you accomplish over there?
Well, it goes back quite a way, actually. So the gentleman, one of the two gentlemen who started Rescue Task Force, Gary Becks and Wendell Cutting, started going into Afghanistan in 1987. And at that time, they were bringing food aid to those people that were being impacted under the Soviet occupation.
Yeah.
And while they were there, they were introduced to a gentleman we will refer to in this interview as Ghulam, who was their guide and their aide, and it was actually introduced to them by Armand Karzai, the former head of Afghanistan.
And I assume we're using aliases, listeners, for some of these, so that we don't put anybody in danger who may still be in Afghanistan.
That is correct. And that's why I said we'll call Ghulam.
Yes.
That is not his real name.
Ghulam, okay.
Anyway, Gary, Wendell, and I'm sorry, unfortunately, Wendell has passed, but they all became very close friends and kept in touch. And in 2002, began to shoot the idea around of bringing education literacy centers to women. And of course, that was forbidden under the Taliban.
Right.
But in 2002, after the United States had gone into Afghanistan, they started off by setting up what they called a shade tree project. They used out-of-pocket money and began to meet under trees, literally, and to educate these young and older women, I might add.
Yeah, good for them.
And from that, it developed relatively quickly. Ghulam is a very industrious, very intelligent guy, and we had a very kind sponsor in South California who was helping with all of this. And without going into too much more detail, over the course of the years, Ghulam set up 21 to 23 literacy centers for these women.
My goodness.
We have had, and we're running until June or so of this year, literally weeks before Kabul fell. We had 12,000 students in these schools.
Wow.
3,000 of whom gained enough proficiency to go into secondary school. And I can talk a little bit more about that in a moment.
Oh, my. Yeah, that's amazing.
And some onto college. And it really was amazing. There's a Afghani proverb that Ghulam shared with us saying that those who cannot read are blind. And we want our women to be healthy.
My goodness.
And that may be something we all accept here in the West, but obviously it's a difficult situation in countries like Afghanistan.
Yeah, I know so many countries around the world where people are illiterate, but Afghanistan in particular is so difficult for the women because of the oppressiveness of the Taliban regime.
Indeed, indeed. So now, I would say, just to by a bit of a context, that in Afghanistan, while the United States was there, women could only go on to secondary school if they had demonstrated a certain proficiency level. Mm-hmm. And that was our primary goal. So that these women and children and young women would, on one hand, be able to go to secondary school and develop their education further.
Yeah.
But even for those who were older and were not going on to secondary school, it was of enormous help, not only for their own self-esteem, but it enabled many of them to set up businesses of their own, help their children with their homework, be able to tabulate and read things in supermarkets, things that we take for granted, they were unable to do.
Yeah, there's such an independence in a way that comes with being able to read and not being quite so reliant on someone else to do all of that for you. I can't imagine how difficult that would be. And then the opportunities, of course, that it presents for those who can go on to higher education, to aspire to be, you know, doctors or whatever they want to be. And that's all.
We can only pray that the time comes back in Afghanistan where this kind of work can resume.
We all certainly hope that. What has happened now since the country fell to the Taliban? We hear a lot about it on the news, but what are you hearing from your inside sources who are still on the ground about the situation there right now, especially for the women and girls?
I'm sorry to tell you what we are hearing and seeing, as we've been able to receive some videos as well.
Yeah,
we'll start with the women and the girls. The most recent international news you may have read was that boys are now back allowed into secondary school programs. Girls are not. So notwithstanding the Taliban's promises to treat women equally, that's falling. That is just not happening.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody really believed they would treat women equally, but we had hoped that at least it might be somewhat better than the last time they were in power. And apparently that's not the case.
That's not the case. And we are seeing videos of women and teenage girls being pulled from houses and forcibly married off or given basically to Taliban fighters. That is now resuming. We've seen people beheaded for some of the work they've done.
I was just going to ask, have you had retaliation against any of your teachers or people who worked at these schools?
At this point, we have heard not too much of that.
Good.
In the sense that the teachers have been able to fade back in the background. And I should tell you, these literacy centers were all taking place in the Hazara region of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It's up in the mountains. And although there have been issues in the past, and we'll talk a little bit about some of them, at this point, from what we have heard, they have not gone aggressively after those teachers that were helping. Of course, Ghulam and his family are in hiding, and they fear for their life for good reason.
I can only imagine. What are your, without giving away any details that could
sure.
compromise where they are or their any escape plan they may have, but do you have substantial prospects for getting them safely out of Afghanistan?
Well, we've been working diligently. We started with an organization in Philadelphia called HIAS, mm-hmm. and they connected us to Global Immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And we have all but secured, we're waiting for the word, which we hope any day, something called humanitarian parole or humanitarian parole visas for all of Ghulam and his family. He has five children and a wife with him in hiding, and one child, a daughter, in a neighboring country, without going into details, who at this point is safe, but she's not able to go back into the country.
No.
All of his children, or all of his adult children, helped with the literacy centers. They all have targets on their back.
I bet. And I understand, to be clear now, you've had to close down all of the literary centers. Is that correct?
We did. They were running until literally 2 to 3 weeks before Kabul fell. Ghulam has been quite diligent in making this happen. And his support staff, meaning the people in the Hazara region, have been incredible.
What happened to all of the materials? Were any of those salvaged, or did they have to be, you know, burned or destroyed to prevent, you know, tying them to the people that are doing the work?
Sure. To my knowledge, the books and the literacy tools we've received have been dispersed and hidden, and they're just not out and visible.
Yeah. So now, what about for the teachers or anyone else that helped you there? Is any hope of getting any of them out, or do they want to leave?
Well, most of them are back with their families.
Mm-hmm.
We have not been involved yet in trying or hoping to get any of them out. And it actually has not come up in discussion with Ghulam yet.
Yeah.
But I suspect that's going to be a bridge too far for us, as much as it's hard for me to say that.
Yeah, I can imagine. It has to be just devastating for the girls who attended those schools and learned to read and had such hopes for the future, as well as for the older women too, who do still possess that knowledge now that they didn't have before. So there's something, you know, that all of your hard work brought to bear there. But Do you have any hope that maybe someday the pendulum may switch the other way, that perhaps, is there any hope of the Taliban, in your view, someday falling from power, or that international pressures could be brought to bear while they're in power to perhaps, you know, persuade the Taliban to ease up on at least some of the restrictions on the women and girls?
Well, both the United States and the international community have already put substantial pressure on the Taliban. They have threatened things diplomatically, forgive me.
Yeah.
And as I'm sure you've heard, the U.S. controls quite a bit of currency that they're holding from the Afghan government, and the international community holds another piece as well. Whether that will be used as leverage or not, I don't know. But I will tell you, I am not optimistic for the foreseeable future. The pendulums invariably swing in history one way and the other. But
it could be generations or decades before.
I am quite fearful that it will be, yes.
Yeah.
But you are right. The girls and the women, some of them have gone on, and obviously those with significant professional careers may have a lot of difficulty continuing those careers. They will always have their knowledge inside of them. They will be able to help their children in school, as they do. Mm-hmm. Presumably, you know, many of the day-to-day activities that have already been engendered will be able to continue. But unfortunately, educating further, unless they take it upon themselves to help each other, is a dim prospect for the foreseeable future. And it makes my heart quite heavy to have to say that.
Yeah, it's such a tragedy.
Stephen, if I may, Miriam, I wanted to, just to give you on that note, I have with me a quote from one of the young women who wrote in appreciation. We had a board member, by the way, go to Afghanistan just before COVID and visit these centers, and they were thriving. And of course,
I know I've interviewed Gary Beck about them in the past, and he was so proud of it, and it just sounded like such wonderful things were being accomplished over there.
It was tremendous. And this young woman wrote how she was blind. She not literally, she said, I was blind. And I have been my eyes have been treated with the light of knowledge. Mm. And to me, that just speaks volumes as to what this brought the young women and the older women and what they are now going to be missing out on. And it's just a tragedy. It's a tragedy upon tragedies in Afghanistan.
You know, it is a tragedy on tragedy. A little history, you know, for listeners, the U.S., of course, has been at war in Afghanistan for over 20 years under four different presidents. It started under George W. Bush after 9/11, you know, of course, going in to try to hold Al-Qaeda accountable. It continued under Barack Obama, even after the capture of Osama bin Laden. President Donald Trump forged a peace treaty with the Taliban and freed some 5,000 Taliban prisoners and promised withdrawal of U.S. troops, but delayed actually doing that, the pullout, until after he left office. I don't believe that they worked to evacuate some of the people at risk. At least there were certainly many left behind.
Yep.
Joe Biden, I suppose he could have canceled that, but he chose to honor the Trump agreement, delayed it a few months, but ultimately did withdraw all the troops, trying to get them out by the 20-year anniversary of 9/11, mm-hmm. and, you know, did get about 100,000 civilians out, and one of the largest evacuations ever. But there were many others who were left behind, and they certainly grossly underestimated how quickly the country would fall to the Taliban, if they believed that would happen at all, and how quickly the Afghan government crumbled. I mean, it's been blamed on corruption and ghost troops on the payroll and all kinds of things. But in hindsight, I got to ask, Stephen, as somebody who, you know, has had people on the ground there forever, what do you think could have done differently? Do you think any of these presidents, you know, could have changed the course of the outcome? Was Biden wrong to actually end the war? Or could more have been done to stop a takeover and prevent those most vulnerable without just, you know, a slaughter of U.S. troops? We, of course, had ISIS-K in there, too, you know, plotting attacks on our troops at the end.
Well, you'll forgive me if I am a bit diplomatic when it comes to specific kinds of politics.
Yeah.
I think it's very clear that there could have been more preparation. One of the shames here, in our case with Ghulam, for example, was that he had already applied for a visa. And he was, I think, 10 days away from his interview at the embassy when Kabul fell.
Oh, how God, how awful. How long ago did he apply for his visa?
I think once the writing was on the wall with the arrangement for with under President Trump, he began the process. The application had to go through a number of steps because he was, of course, applying for seven family members.
So it's been through two administrations then. And
it goes back at least to early part this year. But he was, again, I have to stress how dedicated this man and his family and his community were in pursuing this project. Against all odds.
We've certainly heard about some people who'd had their applications in for, years and still didn't get the approval to get out, including some of the Afghans who helped our troops who were translators or things.
I know,
some of the contractors, and the contractors are gone and they can't get their records. So
you can write off the haste to any number or the rapidity with which the government and the defenses fell.
Mm-hmm.
There are those who are inside that would have told you all along it was going to go quickly, in part because forgetting even the corruption and everything else, that you had soldiers that were demoralized, that knew they were ultimately not going to have the protection and were faced with fighting the Taliban and getting killed,
mm-hmm.
or giving up perhaps and surviving.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of many contributing factors. Could more have been done? I suspect so. I wish so. I'm hoping that our government, and as you mentioned, the international community, can bring the pressure to bear to at least help those that are there get out, and then ultimately, over time, try to establish a fairer society.
Is there more that the United Nations can do right now in terms of, I'm seeing some reports of hunger across Afghanistan, meeting basic needs right now? Is that something that is being done, or is the Taliban blocking things like that?
It's quite clear that hunger is a developing problem, and more problems will surface over the coming weeks and months. I have heard, and I can't tell you that I have more advanced sources than you, these various food projects are being discussed and tentatively set up. It is an open question as to what the Taliban will allow. I wouldn't draw the analogy too far, but you've seen before, we've heard stories of mass starvation in North Korea, and they don't allow certain kinds of food aid in. So it is yet to be seen. But you can also be assured that if there is an opportunity, as small as we are, Rescue Task Force will seize that opportunity and do whatever we can do.
Yeah, your people have been absolutely courageous going into some of the most dangerous situations all around the world. Can you talk a little bit, Stephen, about some of the other projects that Rescue Task Force is working on right now in different parts of the world?
I would love to, but I'd like to take a moment first to tell you that I am really in awe of these coordinators. They have done incredible things at substantial risk. Not to digress too far, we have a coordinator who was working with, among other things, she's in Myanmar, and we've had a number of projects set up in Myanmar, and she was one of our most significant assistants there. She is now stuck there with her brand new child and her recent husband. Her work, individually, somewhat apart from Rescue Task Force, had to do with helping people that were victims of sex trafficking and getting them across the border and out of Myanmar, the border primarily being Thailand. But we had set up a number of projects in Myanmar that she and two other people were instrumental with, in terms of bringing food aid to remote villages, bringing education. We had started projects that are continuing now in several countries in Southeast Asia.
Very good.
That include water filters that can be bought very inexpensively. We, of course, donate them and can bring fresh water to homes. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in various countries. We have, as I said, education projects. One of my personal and Gary's favorite projects we've run now in Cambodia as well as Laos, which is bringing hygiene education to young women who might otherwise, the problem of dealing with menstruation at a young age in these countries very often is a taboo subject. It's not discussed. And so The young women may drop out of school because they're embarrassed by getting their period. They may feel shame about what's going on. And even worse, they may be using things that are not clean and healthy and can ultimately impact them very negatively.
Oh my goodness, I didn't know that.
So we have set up these projects in various countries in Southeast Asia, and so far it's been very successful.
Well, good for you. Now, you're also doing some disaster relief projects. I understand you've been active recently in Haiti. What can you tell us about the situation there and what you're doing?
So Gary, among his other life journeys, is a former firefighter and a former medic from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And when he first set up with Wendell Rescue Task Force so long ago.
Yeah, and we should mention, by the way, for our local listeners here in San Diego East County, a lot of you may remember Wendell, who used to be a top staffer for Congressman Duncan Hunter way back when. Senior, Duncan Hunter Senior, I should add.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And his brother, Larry, is a board member still.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we, Wendell has a few projects we've dedicated specifically to him. I did not have the pleasure of meeting Wendell, but I have heard just wonderful, wonderful things.
Everybody said good. I know liberal Democrats, you know, who may have disagreed with the congressman's politics, but everybody praised Wendell and his good works and certainly the work of Rescue Task Force, which is
Politics aside,
yeah,
we like to think most people are good humanitarians, and that's what really should bring us all together.
Yeah, it definitely. So back to Haiti.
So we started Rescue Task Force as a response team, and we have been there for earthquakes and hurricanes and tidal waves and
yeah.
so forth. So with Haiti, we arranged to bring in various supplies by the container, working with another organization not far from you, World Emergency Relief, which has done just fantastic things all over the world. Primarily with logistics in terms of securing what we call goods in kind and getting them delivered. And we work hand in hand with World Emergency Relief. So we have worked with them to bring aid to a number of countries. We had a container of medical supplies that went down to El Salvador in May of this year to help with COVID. And as you pointed out, we had supplies going to Haiti recently, primarily actually relief supplies for the workers that were there.
Mm-hmm.
To help the rescue workers that came and give them assistance and aid and drink and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. And you're helping with Hurricane Ida right now. Whereabouts?
Also in coordination with World Emergency Relief, getting truckloads of supplies to the people that need them.
Yeah. Well, you're doing so much amazing work. Stephen, if listeners out there want to help out, what kind of help do you need?
We could always use funding. I'm sure it's a trite response, but I have to tell you what draw me. I've been working with RTF now for about 10 years, and I will continue for the foreseeable future. One of the many things that struck me about Rescue Task Force is that it runs on an ungodly budget. We have 95 to 98% of the money that we receive goes directly into our projects.
Yeah.
We don't have paid staff. This is a labor of love
for
those of us who are working that hard. And anything that we get, goods and primarily money, we channel to these projects. We have wheelchair people, projects bringing wheelchairs to people in Asia that could not walk. And in Central and South America. Mm. We have, as I said, water filter projects. And let me take a moment, and I want to respond to your question directly, but I want to share a story with you.
Okay.
When we first went to the Mesquite Coast in Honduras, and we were in a very remote area, and the villages there were suffering terribly from parasites and diarrhea. Most of the kids we saw had extended bellies, distended bellies, really. And we brought them these little water filters that are made with clay and sand and a little bit of magic silver. And filter out 99.9% of the toxins and so forth that help, and parasites particularly. And going back a year later, we saw one distended belly.
Wow. What a
success. That's the kind of impact a $10 water filter can
have. Amazing.
And so that's what we will do. We work with local coordinators, local volunteers who are not paid, people like Gulan. Mm-hmm. Or the woman I mentioned in Myanmar, who are doing this to help their community. And we don't generally don't go in there and set up massive projects that need lots of ongoing support where people have to continue to pour money in. We set up the local infrastructure on a shoestring budget, make sure that it's self-sustaining with our local people.
Very good.
And continue to provide aid. We set up medical clinics and mobile dental clinics where we go to these more remote areas where they haven't seen doctors and dentists. These are all volunteers. They come from medical schools and dental schools. They're professors or dental students or recent graduates that give of their time. And all RTF has to do in the case of bringing containers or helping these things is either to get the transportation so we can get these goods and these people to where they need to go, or in the case of the water filters, buy these water filters for what is really a pittance that save lives.
So it sounds like you need funding, maybe transportation, if somebody out there, you know, owns trucks or something.
Well, generally it's funding because we are working with places like World Emergency Relief that have these other established projects. Mm-hmm. We've set up a project in Philadelphia. I think you have something similar in Southern California where we have refrigerators and food deserts in the cities.
Wow.
Where people can come, and it's right here in California. There are several, for example, in Los Angeles.
Nice.
Where we're donating refrigerators, and then the community restocks them. But when we can, we will restock them. And those who can't afford food will come and take something out of the refrigerator.
That's great.
So little funding, and most of our funders are relatively small funders. It goes a tremendous way.
Yeah.
With very, very little overhead.
Do you need more volunteers?
We are sometimes reluctant to take volunteers. They will need to have special training before they come on missions with us.
Mm-hmm.
But that will be something we hope to do more of in the future.
Very good.
We have to make sure, of course, that those volunteers can pay their own way because, again, we work on a shoestring budget.
Yeah. And listeners, if you want to donate or get involved or learn more about Rescue Task Force, you can also sign up for their wonderful newsletter that keeps you abreast of all the things they're doing around the world. You can do that by going to www.rescuetaskforce.org. I'm going to let you have the final word today, Stephen. And certainly our hearts go out to your coordinator, Gulan, and his family over there and everyone that's been impacted. But I'm going to let you have the last word. What else would you like our listeners to know that we haven't already gone over?
To the listeners, I will say if anyone wants to reach out to me in particular, I will respond directly to them. I'm happy to share information or answer questions, do what I can to give more color or keep them posted. To you, I obviously want to say thank you for this opportunity to let your listeners know what's going on and what we all can do to help. It certainly is, I would request that your listeners write to their congressmen and ask them to do what they can to help all those people who help the United States and are trying to help their own country, to do what we can to help them.
Very good. I know of our East County representatives, I've been getting emails from them, and they all seem to be working on this issue and trying to, you know, lobby the Biden administration and the international community to do more in various ways. So we certainly hope that that there's some hope for it to improve a little bit, and certainly to get Gulan and his family safely out of Afghanistan.
And prayers never hurt either. So
yeah,
keep everyone in our hearts.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we all need to work together in this world.
We should all be doing that. The whole world, I think, now, lifting up a prayer and a plea for the safety of the people in Afghanistan, and especially the women and the girls over there who are just so vulnerable that maybe someday there will be an opportunity for them, once again.
Amen to that.
Stephen, I want to thank you very, very much for taking time out of your, busy week to speak with us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you so much, Miriam. Have a wonderful day.
You too.